Well, like Kimi Räikkönen at Ferrari, the Autosport podcast is back. Okay, we're about as frequent as a competitive Williams, but let's hope it's worth the wait. Joining me, your host, Henry Hope Frost, are a horde of pod regulars, the sort of steady hands you'd put in for a wet night stint at Le Mans. They are Editor-in-Chief Andrew Vandenberg.
Hello.
Magazine Editor Charles Bradley.
Hello.
And News Editor Glenn Freeman.
Hello, Henry, and thank you for such a wonderful introduction.
You're so welcome. So, the big news then in the break during the summer was the return of Kimi Räikkönen to Ferrari. Given that they paid him a huge amount of money not to race back in 2010, this has got to be considered a bit of a surprise. What changed?
Well, I got a bit of insight in this at Goodwood at the weekend. I was sat down with my old friend John Lacey, and he's got quite good insight into the operation at Ferrari, being an old boy. And he was saying that he thinks that they signed Kimi basically as cover because they thought Fernando was off to either Red Bull or somewhere else, or even to take a year out of the sport. And they felt there was no way that they could settle for Felipe Massa, maybe promoting a young guy like maybe Nico Hülkenberg or Jules Bianchi into the number two slot. So they felt they needed another number one driver just in case he left them. So I think that's one of the reasons they're in the situation they are.
Another big reason I'd probably look at is the fact they haven't won anything for a long time, aside from races here and there. They fought for championships, but they haven't won a driver's championship since 2007 and haven't won a constructor since 2008. So maybe after all this time, you know, it's 96 when they signed Schumacher and Irvine. Ever since then, they've really gone for having number ones and number twos. And they've maybe finally decided that that doesn't work anymore.
I think it's also symptomatic or emblematic of the power structure within Ferrari, and maybe the Montezemolo is not quite as hands-on now, because while there was a bit of tension between those two, Kimi got on really well with the rest of the team. And so while he'll probably put up quite a strong fight to Alonso, is how it'll work politically within the team is probably be quite neutral, and that should be a good thing for them.
And they've ended up with two world champions as teammates within Maranello for the first time in 60 years.
Who were the last two H gone?
Giuseppe Farina and Alberto Ascari, Italian Grand Prix 1953.
Ah, and you'd probably argue that it's their strongest lineup across two cars since Prost and Mansell in 90, wouldn't you? Obviously, Mansell didn't have a world championship by then. But, you know, that relationship was fractious.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And that was the last time they went through it. But our guys in the paddock seem to think that, picking up what Andy said about Montezemolo, it's Domenicali that's forced this one through to get Kimi in. I'm sure Montezemolo is well aware of the fact that they paid 20 million quid just a few years ago to get rid of Kimi. So bringing him back looking at that, does seem a bit of a strange decision.
Mm. I still think Lacey Berger was quite a good partnership, where you could argue they were equal number ones and got on pretty well.
Trust you to mention a Lacey again.
Obviously.
Unbelievable. After eight seasons with Ferrari, Felipe Massa's now out of a driver. What do we think's going to happen with him next year?
Brazilian stock cars.
With Rubens and Caca Bueno.
Well, there are plenty of sort of midfield Formula One. I really can't see him going to any top line team at all. You know, obviously you'd think Lotus would be the highest level seat you could go to, but I'm pretty sure Hülkenberg's going there. It makes a lot of sense. I think a Hülkenberg-Grosjean lineup's pretty good, which leaves you with people like Force India Williams, and surely you need a budget these days to go there. And has he got that? You know, he's been paid quite well over the last eight seasons at Ferrari. He's quite popular in Brazil, but can you see him bringing requisite money there?
No.
The unfortunate thing for Felipe, obviously, I don't think any of us would dispute how good he was before his accident, but we've never been sure about him since. I'd like to see Hülkenberg get the Lotus drive, but there's a slight worry there that that's a team whose financial situation hasn't always been secure, and they're trying to do some sort of greater commercial tie-up with Renault. And South America, and particularly Brazil, is a huge market for Renault, so Massa could play a huge role in that. So that might be where he gets his reprieve.
Yeah.
There's an interesting piece in this week's magazine that Mark Hughes has written, sort of reappraising just how good Massa was in 2008. And it's easy to sort of denigrate him, and I have done many times in these pods, and I think Ferrari were more than patient, but he was fantastic in that second half of that 2008 season. And I think Glenn did a little tweet about it when Massa announced that he was leaving the team, that he would have been a very, very worthy champion that year. Some of those performances that he put in were, I mean, he left Kimi for dead, and I think we should remember just how good he was when he was on it.
And also remember some of the serious misfortune he had in 08. You know, there were a couple of errors early in the year, but the things that actually cost him were things like the pit stop drama in Singapore, the engine blowing up at the end of Hungary when he wiped the floor with Lewis Hamilton in a head-to-head fight. And I think there was another one as well. But
I won't mention the 25,000 spins at Silverstone.
Yeah, even Raikkonen spun in that British Grand Prix, I think. Yes. That 08 Ferrari was hideous in the wet.
You mentioned Nico Hülkenberg, Glenn. There is obviously a top drive going at Lotus now Kimi's left. Do you think that his performance at Monza was very timely?
It was, but you'd hope that Formula One teams make their decisions based on more than a one-off performance at the peak of the silly season. I think all of us sat here have probably covered Nico at some point in his junior career, and I think most of us have been convinced of him probably since about 2006. He's long overdue an opportunity. And if Monza served to be a timely reminder, then all the better for it.
Yeah.
There was a wet race he did in the second season of A1GP at Malaysia that he won by 40 seconds. It might have been more than that. That was one of the most convincing performances I've ever seen. And that did it for me. And I think, Charles, you would have seen him when he did that GP2 Asia race where he won by a similar margin that just destroyed the field.
Qatar night race where he just rewrote the way that people looked at race strategy as well, because everyone was coming in early and then doing a long stint on fresher tyres, and he just stayed out. And they said the radio wasn't working. They said it was just a mix-up. But I think it was actually a preordained strategy. But they knew he was good enough to execute it.
Let's not forget that back when he was managed by Willy Weber, Michael Schumacher's manager, he was considered the next Schumacher, and Sebastian Vettel sort of jumped him on that one. Yeah. And we've always thought, and well, I think known that he can be a star, and he's still got that chance, and you just hope that he doesn't get mired in the midfield for much longer.
Yeah, I mean, pole position at a Williams, leading the Brazilian Grand Prix in a Force India, and he's led in China this year in a Sauber. You know, what more does a guy have to do?
I do worry about jumping teams so much, and also Ferrari have been on an enormous recruitment drive of all the good people. I'm not saying there aren't any good people left at Lotus, but a lot of the big name people are leaving. I wonder how strong that team will be if he does go there.
Yeah. Back to Kimi quickly. He'd been linked to Red Bull, of course, hadn't he? That drive's now gone to Daniel Ricciardo. Do you think the Australian is up for a race-winning opportunity?
Well, obviously, I've been picking our resident F1 expert on the midfield and the back of the grid, which is Ed Straw. He's been following the Toro Rosso battle very closely, probably for the last 2 years, 18 months, something like that. And the belief for a while in Red Bull, he tells me, is that they've always thought Ricciardo was good enough that if he had a pole position, he could drive away from everyone at the front and produce a race performance over 60 laps or whatever. Until this year, they weren't convinced about him turning around a bad weekend or a weekend where the car wasn't right or he didn't qualify well. But since the availability of Webber's seat has been known, it's Ricciardo that's really stepped up. And you've only got to look at a race such as Spa, where he didn't qualify well and raced his way into the points. He's shown, or he's suggested, that he's got all the tools. So I'm glad to see him get a chance.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, I think Verne's been a little bit unlucky in that I think in the long term, potentially wise, you could argue that he might actually be the better bet. You know, it's just his qualifying pace that seems to let him down for me. And, I think it's very sensible to keep him on, keep him in Toro Rosso and see what he can do when he gets a bit more experience.
I've no idea whether Ricciardo's up for it or not, but I'm just really pleased to see a new face be given a chance in the top team to possibly, you know, shake it up a bit, because we've had the same guys winning races for quite a long time now, and it'll be good to see a different guy up there.
Another good thing, picking up on Charles saying about Toro Rosso keeping Verne, that was a mistake they made last time. They got rid of their two proven hands, brought in two rookies, and have spent the last couple of years trying to work out if they're any good or not, because they haven't had a barometer. So if they keep Verne in the other car, he gets a chance to prove himself long term, but they can also judge whoever they put in the second seat.
Do you think the guys will be worried about the sort of Buemi-Alguersuari situation, where they were sort of in a sense, flogging a dead horse, weren't they, for a couple of years? And both those guys have effectively disappeared, haven't they?
Well, you've still got Buemi doing good things in World Sports Cars, and obviously does all the simulator work as well back.
Yeah, I mean, sort of in a Toro, in a Red Bull F1 context.
Oh yeah, in an F1 context. Yeah, but I think it's a tricky call, isn't it? I mean, they did have quite a few chances. Alguersuari should never have been there in the first place. It was way too early for him. Buemi, I just don't think he had that extra yard of pace that you really needed to make it in Formula One. So I think he probably did have the better chance, the two of them. With Vern, I still think there's more to come. I still think, you know, I think if we sat down this time next year and he's in the same position, then it'll be like a lot of Red Bull junior drivers, it's time for the elbow.
Yeah. So Fenn ends up staying at Toro Rosso next year. Who do we think is going to replace Ricciardo?
The favourite still has got to be Antonio Felix da Costa. You know, he's top of the queue as far as Red Bull juniors go. He's not had a great 2013 up to this point. He got his season back on track last weekend in Hungary with a win, which I think was perfect timing, really, because up to that point, Red Bull were starting to have their doubts, which, based on the way he finished last year, winning four of the last five World Series by Renault races, it's amazing to think that Red Bull were suddenly doubting him. But that's an example of how quickly they can change their minds and how fickle they can be. And that's the risk you take if you're on the Red Bull junior scheme. Mm.
I mean, I completely agree with Glenn. I think if da Costa delivers for the rest of the season, he's pretty much nailed on. But I'd like to see one of those old-fashioned shootouts, you know, that they used to have, like when Button got his Williams drive. And I think someone like Robin Frins, you know, really deserves an opportunity. Magnussen's boy is doing brilliantly in 3.5, and I'd like to see him have an opportunity. I think there are three or four really decent contenders there, but given it's a Toro Rosso, it'll be someone that's been from the Red Bull Junior programme. If it's not da Costa, I guess it has to be Sainz Junior, but it's probably too soon for him.
Yeah, Sainz was really impressive, we're told, at the young driver test when he drove for Toro Rosso.
Especially on muddy grass.
Yeah, he's good on opposite lock. So he's got half a chance, and Helmut Marko name-dropped him to us a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about da Costa. I think it's just a measure to keep the pressure up on da Costa and tell him that it's not a done deal. But Toro Rosso have even been looking at drivers who aren't part of the Red Bull family. So if they decide that da Costa's not ready and Sainz does go off and do maybe FR 3.5, they have looked at who else is out there, be it Felipe Nasr or someone like that. But I still think it'll be a Red Bull Junior.
I'll tell you what, if these new 2014 engine regs, if these new turbo engines are a bit vicious in their power input, you might want a driver who can deal with oversteer. And I think both Vern and Sainz would actually be perfect for that, because they've both got really exuberant driving styles.
I'd put Carlos Sr. in it, frankly. he did the festival in a Van Diemen 20 years ago, 30 years ago even. This F1 musical chairs game is really in full swing. Hülkenberg's seat at Sauber is available, obviously. I say obviously, it's not obviously, as it hasn't been done yet. It's looking like it might be taken by an 18-year-old Russian called Sergei Sirotkin. Many of our listeners have probably never seen him in action. Is he ready for that jump, aged 18?
Well, I'm covering him this year in World Series, and he's not ready. That doesn't mean that one day down the line he might not be good enough. There's a lot of potential there. You know, for him to have scored podiums this year as a teenager up against these guys who've been doing this all their life and are being groomed by F1 teams and have been groomed for a long time, that's an impressive achievement. But he's by no means ready, and by rushing him in, they run the risk of wasting that potential. It's interesting, actually. Sam Bird, GP2 front runner at the moment and a Mercedes test driver, he did a bit of driver coaching with Sirotkin over the winter, because Sam used to race for that team, ISR. And he said the same thing. He said he's got a lot of potential, a lot of raw ability, but he's still got so much to learn. And that's natural for a kid who's only just turned 18.
Yeah, I do worry. You know, you get in and next year's car is a big change. You know, Sauber have been struggling for finances, which is one of the reasons that Sirotkin's likely to be there. How good's that car going to be? Say it's not particularly good back of the grid. He's written off before he's even had a chance. And I think, especially, you know, we're going to have a Russian Grand Prix, it's important to have a Russian talent. And if we've got one here, which it looks like we've got, we should be nurtured. A load of Friday tests, I think, would be a very good idea with a decent barometer, as we were talking about earlier, in the two main seats. If Massa was to go anywhere, I think a Sauber return would be a quite nice thing.
I've got a good scenario. You put Sam Bird in the Sauber and put Sirotkin in the Russian time GP2 car for a season, and then Sam's allowed to sink or swim, and Sirotkin goes to Sauber the year later.
Also, Henry, you said it's Hülkenberg's seat and then tried to correct yourself. I wouldn't be sure that Gutierrez is guaranteed there either.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Yeah. Right, that's more than enough of the driver market, thank you. The past two races at Spa and Monza were supposed to be Red Bull's weakest tracks, but somehow Sebastian Vettel now has an enormous championship lead. Are we fearful that it's all over and Sebastian's on his way to title number four?
Yes.
Excellent.
I remember us doing the pre-season podcast and predicting Vettel for a fourth straight championship. Yeah. And at the time, it was like, if you're a gambler, you have to look at the most obvious thing that's going to happen. And it was difficult to see what could change that would make that happen. And absolutely nothing has changed. My understanding is that Red Bull put a massive drive into updating the cars to see if they could win in Spa and Monza and then effectively cruise for the rest of the season. I believe Glenn's got some stats looking at the Red Bull and Vettel's record at the final six races of the season. And if anything were to give them confidence that maybe this is in the bag, I believe this is probably it.
Yeah, I've crunched the numbers and I'll just read out the remaining races and how many times Vettel has won there already. So Singapore twice, Korea twice, Japan three times, India twice, Abu Dhabi twice, Texas, he hasn't won there yet, but he lost last year's race by 6/10 to Lewis Hamilton. And he's won the Brazilian Grand Prix once, and plus Mark Webber's won there twice.
Oh, so dear.
You've got to think that Vettel and Red Bull are in reasonable shape for the rest of the season.
So it's all to play for then.
That's wide open.
Oh, dear. It's Singapore this weekend, of course, a track where Vettel goes well. It's also a track where Britain Paul de Rester traditionally goes well, but the wheels seem to have fallen off a bit at Force India. What do we think is going on?
Well, tyres is the obvious explanation. Since Pirelli had those terrible blowouts in a British Grand Prix, they changed the way in which it's constructed, and it seems to have been pretty benign, except for the effect it's had on Force India, and they have just tumbled backwards at a hell of a rate to the point where they're struggling to get out of Q1 now, whereas previously they were Q3 contenders. I think this is a really, really important weekend for de Rester. He's had some great results there. I think he was fourth last year. It's one of his really key tracks, and I'm not sure what the situation with their driver lineup is next year, but this is a very timely opportunity to remind them of the ability that he's clearly got.
Yeah, and when he did have a quick car underneath him, he had so many problems in qualifying, didn't he? Going out in Q1 for a couple of really random reasons. So I totally agree. I think now's the time he's really got to prove himself to keep his place.
Well, remember, he nearly snatched pole for Spa. Mm. I was sat on the bank at Puan, and for ages we thought we were going to see Paul de Rester's first pole position through a moment of genius timing and pulling the lap out. You've got to have a little bit of sympathy for Force India, I think, this year. As a smaller team, they would probably go off the boil a little bit as a development race catches up with them. But by all accounts, them and probably Lotus and maybe a little bit Ferrari as well, they tried to design cars for very fragile Pirelli tyres. And then through a lot of complaining and eventually some safety issues, we've ended up with tyres that suit other people better. And probably Force India haven't got the resources to respond to that mid-season like the other teams can.
Mm. I think in the months to come as well, people will be looking towards 2014, looking at who's got Mercedes engines, because the buzz is that the Merc's going to be the fastest, the Renault's going to be somewhere thereabouts, and the Ferrari's probably third in the queue at the moment from what all my engineering people are telling me. So a seat like Force India is probably going to be worth its weight in gold, I think, with the Merc power, if it's as good as everyone says it's going to be.
Is it fair to compare Paul against Adrian Sutil? Sutil's not a superstar. He's quite experienced. Should Paul have been doing a better job against Sutil?
I think he has done a good job. If you look at their qualifying record, I mean, I heard a comment the other day when James Collado was in the car on the Friday. Someone compared Collado's time to de Rester and said, oh, well, if Sutil had been in, the gap would have been even bigger. But you look at their qualifying record and it doesn't suggest that at all. The important thing for Paul is to finish strongly, because in his first year against Sutil and against Hülkenberg last year, he sort of fell away when we get to these new Tilke tracks that seem to have a very specific style. Mm. And Paul's got to crack that this year and finish strongly, because as unfortunate as it is, the things that happen more recently and the things that happen at the end of the season, that's what the people remember going into the winter.
I completely agree with Glenn's point, but I also think one of the problems you have when you're in a midfield team like Force India is you get very little TV exposure. Sutil happened to find himself on the correct tyre strategy at Australia and got a lot of airtime for that. It's like, oh, he's come back and he's dominated the rest. I think he beat him by a second and a half in that race.
And that was because Paul wasn't allowed to overtake him at the end. Yeah, there were team orders.
And I think that skewed the perspective of how they're getting on. The rest is way ahead in points. I think he's ahead on the qualifying head-to-head. I still think he needs a couple of really strong results, but I think he's done about as much as he can do.
Right, away from Formula One then, the biggest news has been Juan Pablo Montoya leaving NASCAR and returning to IndyCar with Penske. He's already talking about winning the Indy 500 next year, and Glenn's got his hand up. But at almost 40 years of age, brackets, he's only 37, can he still cut it in a single-seater?
I stand by that being almost 40.
Super maths.
That's fine. Worryingly, that means I'm almost 30, though. To answer your question, can he still cut it? We don't know the answer to that. He doesn't know it because he hasn't jumped in a car or a simulator, so he hasn't driven a single seater for a long time. But how great is it to see a driver and a team just go, right, let's just do the deal and then we'll work out and then we'll see. People don't take those sort of risks. They seem to want to protect their image by not jumping in a car and not being one with it straight away. But Montoya's got that classic old school attitude. If I fancy this, I'm going to do all I can. He's already got trying to get himself back in shape, get off that NASCAR diet. And you know, he's taking it seriously, and it's a great story. I hope it's a success.
Yeah,
I've got two questions. First one, can he fit in the car? Can't answer that one. Second one, probably ask Andy over there, because he was in Baltimore. Have Penske just done this deal to annoy Chip Ganassi?
They were at great pains in one of their press releases to go, we've discussed this with Chip. We've made sure that it was, you know, they were happy with this and everything. So I'd say yes.
I think the main person they've annoyed with this deal is Michael Andretti, because he was putting all the money in place first and was then going to sign Montoya. Penske did the opposite. So, right, we'll sign him and then we'll try and find a way of paying for it. And, you know, they took a risk, but they figured that was the way to get their man.
I think he's in for a bit of a rude awakening on how competitive that field is when it comes to road and street courses, because it might not be full of superstar names, but there's some really decent drivers in there.
Yeah.
But I think that his idea of winning the 500 is in no way fanciful. I think he'll be straight on it there. He'll definitely have a good car and excellent strategy from Penske, and I can see him winning that, and it will be an amazing story if he does.
Yeah.
The other difference to when he went there before, obviously he was a young, hungry, single-seater racer then, but there was probably bigger disparity between the cars back then. You had chassis rivalry, engine manufacturer rivalry. We've still got a bit, we've got two engines at the moment, but other than that, it's pretty much a spec formula. So even if you go to Penske, you've got the best car, but the slower cars are not going to be as far behind as they might have been when he was winning for Chip.
Charles, has his NASCAR sojourn been disappointing?
Yeah, definitely. From a point of view that he didn't quite crack the ovals. From the road course point of view, looked absolutely fine. Won a couple of races, won nationwide first, and went on to win in the Cup. But never cracked winning an oval race. Got into the chase one year, looked quite convincing that year. And again, just wasn't able to nail it. But he was up against Jimmy Johnson, so quite difficult.
Mm. I think it's quite hard to discern between whether he didn't make it or how poor Ganassi were, because Jamie McMurray is a very competent driver and he hasn't won a cup race for a couple of years, and even that was a super speedway, which is a bit of a lottery. I think they're probably the most disappointing team in NASCAR given the resources and personnel they've got, and I think shaking it all up and bringing in a hotshot like Kyle Larson is good, but I think it's a little bit unfair to put the blame at the door of Montoya for the failure. He should have won that Brickyard 400 race where he got that spurious speeding penalty. He would have won, I think it was at New Hampshire earlier this year, when there was a really late green and white checker and Johnson just did him at the restart. He did him so badly at the restart, they've changed the rules to stop that happening again. and I think he's a competitive oval driver. He's often up there, but I just don't think that Ganassi car has been anywhere near good enough.
Well, let's not underplay the sort of coup this is for IndyCar. You know, NASCAR's been battering it for years and years and years. Obviously the split didn't do American open wheel racing any favours at all, but this is almost like one of the first strikes back to say that we've taken somebody here who's a star performer and we're going to take him away from you.
Do you think it might encourage anyone else to make the switch? Are there any sort of potential...
Well, Kurt Busch is looking at doing the 500.
That looks likely.
And Allmendinger is sort of back and forth and whatever.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out the influence of Chevrolet here, because obviously they've got feet in both ponds, if you like. And it wouldn't surprise me if they've smoothed the water to make these things happen.
The other thing is that will determine whether guys look at IndyCar seriously as an alternative is money. There's very few paid drives in IndyCar at the moment, whereas at NASCAR, a few, apart from a few start and parkers at the back, everybody's getting money. They're not taking money. So that will determine it long term.
Okay. A new single-seater series was officially unveiled last week at the FIA's Formula E, and it plans to be the first zero-emission championship. Do we think it will work?
Well, it's certainly a fascinating concept. I'm sure there's many listeners who rail against it because it doesn't feature an internal combustion engine. But as we look ahead into the way energy is going to be provided, I think, you know, it's quite essential. Certainly when you think of city living, having zero emissions vehicles is a very wise move. And this championship reflects that in its all the races are going to be in city centres, 10 venues around the world. There's also a lot of political reasons for why this is a good move. And there's also quite a lot of money sloshing around in various sort of government or mayoral quangos as well to make sure this all happens.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And it's very easy to be cynical about these things, but you look at the people they've got on board, McLaren, Williams, Renault, Michelin, DHL, TAG. All of a sudden, you think all these people can't be wrong. You know, they're not going to back the wrong horse. And I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's something different. It's something new. It's something exciting. And if there's a race in London, brilliant.
It will it's clearly going to start off on the right foot with the money that's behind it and the partners that are behind it. Andy and Charles might be able to answer this one for me, but my worry is its sustainability financially, because at the moment, as Charles said, the money's coming from governments who have budgets to push zero emissions living and stuff like that. But what happens when they come up with their next idea that's looking for the future of their cities and they stop spending their money on electric racing cars and hosting these races? I'm not sure what the answer to that is, and I'd love to know more.
Well, I think the first answer to that is probably to look at the technology behind it. You know, there's going to be increases in the battery technology. There's going to be things like hydrogen cells that are going to come on stream, and road car manufacturers, you know, you only have to look at Volkswagen, Nissan, Renault, people like that who have got EV models in their range. I think there's going to be so many advances, and because they're going to open up from a one make series for the, you know, it's basically going to be a spec car in the future, they want to open that up and allow different technologies to compete with some sort of balance of performance. That's going to be an interesting one to engineer. And I think that's the future. I think it's basically going to be people, rather than, obviously, Renault have put their name to this as sort of a big overarching, you know, we're the strategising people because we know more about electric vehicles than anybody else. I think that's going to start to prick up the ears of people like Volkswagen will go, well, hang on, we're really good at electric cars as well, and we've got a good system. And then maybe we're going to get into some nice technology wars, which is what we want to see, really.
Yeah, and that actually brings up my next question, which is... we know manufacturers come and go from motorsport. Does the fact that this is so technologically advanced sort of safeguard against that?
I think it, in many ways, it mitigates against it, yeah, because the next one with the next lot of technology will want to get involved and showcase theirs. Going back to your point about the races, I think that their hope will be that it brings in a new audience and these races become financially viable on their own. So it's worth them investing in getting them up and running and so that they work as events on their own. And I think the ones that do will succeed and the ones that don't will fall by the wayside. And putting the races in the centre and bringing it to people and having it based around technology, you know, one of the biggest fears I have about motorsport is the aging demographic. I was at these IndyCar and NASCAR races in Bristol and Baltimore. The age of the average fan in NASCAR is worryingly old. They were slightly younger at IndyCar, but you don't see many kids there. Hopefully this will be the sort of thing, you know, get on your iPad or whatever that brings them in.
It's the same in F1. I've been to two GPs this year just on a fan ticket, and there's so few kids at these races. Obviously it's very expensive to take your family to a Grand Prix. But yeah, I'd get exactly the same feeling that it's an older generation are growing up and just staying with the sport, but it's not bringing in many new kids at the moment.
Yeah, never underestimate bringing the race into the people as well. It's one thing to go and stand on a cold, windswept bank at, you know, Brands Hatch, Silverstone, Goodwood, as it was at the weekend. But, you know, if you're in a city centre venue, you know, you can just jump on, let's say, a tube train or a metro or one of Boris's bikes or something to go and see the racing, then you're probably more likely to take the kids along as well, aren't you?
Has the FIA got contracts with these 10 host cities? And are they contractually obliged to build a track? Is it absolutely signed? They will...
The calendar will come out in the next World Motor Sport Council meeting. But yeah, they'll be built to FIA safety standards. And I don't know whether they'll be 1 year, 3 year or whatever year deals, yeah. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, the Formula E Championship's got a 25-year deal with the FIA over this, so don't expect it to be a flash in the pan.
Right. Finally, Charles, just like you've mentioned, you were at Goodwood with me last weekend. It might be an event that some of our listeners perhaps have never been to, given that it's historic racing, but it's so much more than that, isn't it? It's a real sort of lifestyle kind of occasion now.
Yeah, it's an absolute step back in time, really, the way that everyone who attends the event, well, most of the people anyway, dress up in period clothing. We're talking post-war up until 66 when the circuit closed the first time around. And yeah, it's just absolutely amazing to see all the cars of the period, the people dressed like that. You know, there's all sorts of shows. There's the, you know, there's the old Tesco building that you can walk around and look how the shops used to be in the day. You know, it's quite remarkable to see just how many people were there as well. Mm. You know, really, really getting into it, really enjoying and getting into the swing of it. Almost a bit un-British-like, really, in the fact that normally people are quite cynical.
Spirit of the Blitz.
It funnily is, actually. So when it does pour with rain, people don't all wander off and go, oh, it's raining, I'm going to go back into my car. No, they do seem that. My parents would have, you know, got through this. We'd have stood out in the rain with bombs falling and everything like that. So it is quite remarkable, and it was great news to hear that there's going to be a second meeting at Goodwood next year, taking place in March, and the plan is to maybe look to the period after the circuit closed the first time. So we'll have some racing that's post 1966 round Goodwood, which is an amazing circuit, you know, one of the only circuits in Britain that's never been touched and is still in original format.
I didn't realise that they were initially granted 5 days of racing in the very original planning, and of course the revival's only three. Yeah. So they've got these 2 days sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah, and these are noisy days, so they can have whatever decibel outputs they like. So no, it should be exciting times ahead.
I've got a stat for you. That I've just been sitting on. I don't know if it's quite as good as Glenn's Vettel Championship run-in stuff.
It's probably more exciting.
Goodwood held its first meeting 65 years ago today.
That's quite impressive, isn't it?
Well, it depends what day this podcast goes out on.
Today's the 18th of September. Edit that out, Matthew, thank you. Oh, rubbish. Right, we've got one last thing to discuss. I went to the cinema last night and I saw Rush, and I thought it was marvellous. Discuss.
I've seen it too, and I really enjoyed it. You have to sort of throw away all your motorsport history knowledge and just enjoy the ride. And if you do that, it's a great film, really well acted. A brilliant ending that I think all non-motorsport people will just enjoy. And I'm really pleased to hear how well it's gone down with the non-motorsport cognoscenti, and quite disdainful of the snobbish attitude some of the more hardcore people have had towards it, because I think they just need to chill out a little bit and enjoy
absolutely
it.
Right.
Picking up on when this podcast comes out, I'm either seeing it tonight or I've already seen it. But
back in time.
What Andy's talking about there... I'm going to see it tonight, and I'm not expecting another Senna. I'm not expecting a documentary that is factually retelling me the story of the 1976 F1 season.
I'm not going to spoil it for you, but Senna's not in it.
Shame.
Hunt wins.
H.
But is Lauda okay?
Just.
I'm not expecting it. It's not a documentary. It's a Hollywood remake, and the keyword is based on a true story. It's not a total recount of a true story. And we've all enjoyed plenty of films, not about motorsport, that are based on true stories. And sometimes you go and look up the true story and you see where they've taken some creative license. Yep. But that shouldn't hurt your enjoyment of the film. We should all be celebrating the fact that motorsport has made its way onto the big screen.
At this juncture, can I just advise anyone who does see Rush, who feels they need the full story, to go and buy our Hunt Lauda bookazine, which does fill in all the gaps of the true story.
Beautifully done.
Thank you, mate.
Yeah.
I'll just interject with my issue with sports films is that I know what the ending is because I know what happened in time. Like in Invictus, I know that South Africa win the Rugby World Cup on their home territory and Morgan Freeman is Nelson Mandela, quite clearly. But again, I'd also go back to Goodwood on this one because we were, Henry and I were in a debate with some, you know, fantastic stars of years past, Stirling Moss, Emanuele Pirro, Nick Mason was there, Doug Nye.
We were talking
about the fact about these cars and whether that these cars were actually original enough to portray the period that they're trying to. And I think we came to the conclusion that at the end of the day, it's more of a theatre. You know, Goodwood looking as it is today is very much a theatre representing what the past was like. It is not the past. It's not the same drives. It's not the same cars. But it's something that gives you a good reflection on what it was actually like in those times.
Just quickly going back to Goodwood, Henry, can you tell everyone where they can find that Kenny Brack video?
On YouTube.
It's incredible.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and details are in Autosport magazine this week on our Hot on the Web section. Yeah.
Wonderful. And the Will Ferrell.
Anchorman. Anchorman too. Ron Burgundy, Goodwood Revival. An absolute classic. Yeah, Kenny Brack in Adrian Newey's GT40. Steering wheel never straight. Absolutely on it. And it's a very, very quick, undulating circuit with not much runoff. And it's a quality production, unlike this podcast.
Of course. If ever you want proof that motorsport is not something that just anyone can do, it's that video.
Yeah, absolutely right. Amazing. Well, that's it. Thanks, fellas. Our podcasts may be as rare as a Mark Webber win these days, but we hope you enjoyed our latest instalment. And that's a lap.